Support for Bright Public is provided by FM Rotary Foundation's 5th Annual Rotary Ride, September 9th at Lindenwood Park, Fargo. Proceeds go to Gigi's Playhouse and Charism. Registration information is available at fmrotaryride.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because our microphones create one all across the state of North Dakota this time of day. And we love the real ones, too, in our communities across the state where we step on that Main Street and say hello to folks and share our news and opinions. And today we're going to learn a little bit of something from Eden McLeod. Eden is the executive director of the Foundation for Agricultural Rural Resources for Sustainability, easier said as FARMS. Thanks for being with us today. Well, give us the short course. What is FARMS?
Yes. So FARMS is a organization, nonprofit organization that is serving beginning farmers and also rural communities in North Dakota.
Do you have members?
Oh, we do not have members. It's not a member organization. We are just reaching out education to all different people in North Dakota, and you do not need to be a member to get served from us.
How is it supported?
Yes. Yeah, so we have lots of private donors in North Dakota, and we also have USDA funding that supports our programs. And we can go into communities and serve them from all different funding sources and work individually with your community.
So you're always looking for support, right?
That is right.
Okay. The Foundation for Agricultural Rural Resources for Sustainability. That's an important word. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. So I know that word is ongoing and changing, and I think we as an organization have changed. We started with organic agriculture. We are working in regenerative agriculture. And still that sustainability where it might be just not that conventional farmer. Many different avenues that we can look at depending on which direction of farming you want to go in.
Is FARMS one of a kind, or are there other examples of this somewhere in the nation?
Yeah. So many places in the nation actually have some of the same courses as us, and we actually work with them with the Farm Beginnings Collaborative. We have where we go around the nation and meet other organizations, typically nonprofits like ourselves, to work out a new way to educate these different individuals, and it's a farmer to farmer network. That's what sets us aside, these nonprofits aside, to reach individuals.
So your focus is education, and you've got some background in that.
That's right. Yes, I was an ag teacher at a high school in North Dakota prior to this position.
And is there a lot of ag education in rural parts of the state?
Yes, I think that's a really big cornerstone for North Dakota. It's an alternative to, you know, the typical sports, and it's really great for students to be involved in this so that they can gain leadership and practical experience related to agriculture.
Now, you have a farm, a ranch out in the McCluskey,
right,
North Dakota area, and you're in Fargo today.
Yes.
You're in Fargo to promote and to talk about the Farm Beginnings, right?
Right. Yes, the upcoming course that we have. And like I said, we're in Fargo, so we are serving all over North Dakota. This year in Fargo, we are going to be at Lutheran Social Services, and it's a Farm Beginning course where just exploring what you're interested in that's non-conventional farming. It can be even urban agriculture.
Well, this has been going on for about a year in Fargo, hasn't it?
Right.
So how's it gone?
Yes, this is our second year. We had 12 graduates last year, so we want to keep it kind of that smaller scale classroom where you can ask a question anytime and get a response. We have a farmer-to-farmer presentations where we want to really have them help you, and we will do a pre-assessment to find out what you're interested in to make sure that we can help make your farm dreams come true.
Well, if I were a typical applicant, I signed up for Farm Beginnings, what would the experience be like?
Yeah, so there would be 6 sessions in the winter that you would attend on Saturdays. And each session, we'll have homework after that, where at the end, you will have a whole farm plan that you will present to the group to see really where you are. We work back and forth emails with the assignments to make sure you're on the right track. And at the end, you will feel that you can move forward. It's a year-long course now. So this year we're also going to make sure that you attend so many tours and educational opportunities beyond just the classroom to make sure that you're really feeling good about your opportunity.
What kinds of farms are these Farm Beginnings students looking to create?
Yeah, so a lot in the Fargo area are the local, because the local foods movement is big, is the producer for the vegetable production. It might be goat meat. It could be the grass-fed beef. It could be we had wild mushrooms that they were looking at last year. So it varies a lot.
How would you characterize the students? Can you describe them in some way?
Yeah. So it's young and old. I'm going to say it that way. It's the college students that are like, I want to do something else besides typical job when I get out of school. Or they might be coming back to their family farm and they don't know how that opportunity fits for them, but they want to be there on the conventional farm. So they might take on a little piece of this. It can be the retired individual that says, I have some land back there and I should do something with it, and I want a little extra revenue. So we have all different ages.
Are they learning a specific kind of management? Are they learning a certain kind of protocol? I mean, yes. Are there elements to what you're teaching that are unique to this program?
Yeah. Holistic farm management is we have trainers come in that are using this technique. And what it is not just looking at the profit. You know, everybody's worried about the profit in agriculture, but why you're doing it and how your systems can react to the environment and to your community, how it all can fit together. We really want to talk about that and soil health, how the next generation can benefit from what you did to your soil, how you can make it better.
And you seem to have a kind of a custom service approach to this, because Farm Beginnings in Fargo is a very different enterprise or program than the Farm Beginnings in Dickinson, right?
Yes, that's right. So like I said, the community, we want to serve your community. And Dickinson, it's different. They have a winery that needs more local fruit for their wines that they are making. So we're taking the fruit approach, trying to figure out how to get these fruit trees or shrubs on North Dakota land.
Now, how would a community pitch an idea to you? What are you open to?
Yeah, so as long as you are willing to use holistic management and soil practices and better your community, we will tailor a program to you. We typically want to do year-long to follow that producer or that potential producer for a year to make sure that they have all their educational needs met.
Now, as I understand it, you raise cattle,
yes,
obviously, but you also have what you call a market garden, which means you're growing stuff for the farmer's market, huh?
That's right. Yes, I serve two farmer's markets, and I've done a little bit of baskets, like the CSA. It's not a formal CSA. But I like to dabble in that area just to understand the producers in North Dakota. And it's always been kind of a passion. It's neat to be able to do the value added part of it to your operation.
And CSA, Community Sustainable.
Supported agriculture.
Very good. All right. You are raising cattle, but I think you're a bit dissatisfied with the way the market currently works, right?
And right.
How does what we're talking about with farms relate to this?
Yeah. So the direct raising beef and selling it directly to the customer. Right now, our markets can fluctuate all different directions, and we don't know what our check's going to be at the end of the year. So it would be good if we can go back and have consumers buying from the producer. They are able to go see what they're buying. They know exactly where their cuts are coming from. They can pick their animal, and we know it's good quality. We feel that on our ranch. I know many other people do on their ranch as well. So farms wants to serve local foods, and I think that's a really great direction for our North Dakota agriculture to go.
So you're raising Red Angus, and that's kind of a brand you want to promote, huh?
Right, yes. We just chose to do that as our operation. I know that there is good beef. I think it's how you manage your land and how you manage your animals. And good husbandry, I think, is also key, not just the breed.
Well, farms has been around since about 2000, I think. And it's grown, apparently.
Right. Yeah. We went many different directions, and that's kind of the beauty of being a nonprofit. We can do a lot of different things. We just keep in mind that we want to serve the non-traditional, the non-conventional way of agriculture, and we want to grow that in North Dakota.
Well, I Googled where your headquarters used to be, and that's in Tuttle, North Dakota.
Oh, Medina.
Oh, excuse me, Medina, yes. Yes, you're moving to Tuttle.
Yes.
And Tuttle is a small town.
Yeah.
I had to look pretty hard for it. But you're in a school.
Yes, yes. We are helping them repurpose the school, and they are looking at maybe having it as a business center. The school, they have a certified kitchen downstairs for the lunchroom, and so we are trying to help with that local foods part of it and just helping a local or rural community because that's part of our mission.
And I noted that the population for Tuttle in 2010 was 80 people, so this is a bit of an economic development operation
that
for
right.
that community. Huh?
Yes.
Well, what's down the road for farms?
Yeah. So we don't really know, you know, which direction we're going to necessarily go. We just know we want to continue to support rural communities in North Dakota through regenerative, whether it be regenerative, organic, sustainable agriculture.
Regenerative. You can do it over and over again, I take
it? That's right. So it continues to work on the land.
All right. So that's the soil health piece, I
that's
guess.
Right.
Okay. Where's the ultimate goal? Is there a long-term strategic plan here?
Yeah. So like I said, every year that changes, but we know we want to serve North Dakota agriculture for many years to come and grow the communities.
Now, one of the aspects of this farm beginnings in Fargo is that there have been some new Americans involved, haven't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And so that is one area that they are trying to reach with the Growing Together Gardens. Start there where they could understand the practices of gardening in North Dakota compared to their countries. It can be a community, really a community growing event. And many new Americans are interested in farming as they did in their other countries. So we're helping educate them to give them opportunities since they are part of the community.
How did you first get interested in farms?
Yeah, so I, as a producer, when I started my market garden, received a grant to grow through, and that's one of our core programs in farms. And I enjoyed farms programming. I seen a need for it and eventually grew into the position.
So these are microloans? These are small loans?
Yes.
What would a loan be like then? How much?
Yes. So the max amount is $10,000, and we can usually do a $1,000 grant with that. The loans are specifically for people that are involved in our mission, and they are 0% interest for 3 years and 5% after that. So it's a really good deal for North Dakota. It has to be North Dakota residents that are interested in the non-traditional farming.
Well, if you Google farms, that's F-A-R-R-M-S, you'll come to the website.
Right.
And you'll see that you've got lots of events planned, educational events.
Yes.
There's one coming up on September 7th in Fargo called Compost Management.
Right. And so that's with the Growing Together Gardens. They are promoting different market options and everything from hand washing to different gardening ideas, and they're wanting to serve the community to further education.
So how did this particular opportunity develop?
Yeah.
Did they say we need to study compost? Did they say that to you?
No. So the community education in Fargo, they work with the Growing Together and farms partially because we're grant funded through them. And we find things that may be of interest to participants related to agriculture and even urban agriculture
and
in Fargo.
Who's teaching this?
Yeah, so Mindy Grant D. Herrera is our learning specialist, the other employee in farms, and she will be leading this.
Okay, so people are getting good information about stuff they need to know to farm.
Right.
All right.
Yes.
Well, Eden McLeod is the executive director of the Foundation for Agricultural Rural Resources for Sustainability Farms. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, pre-kindergarten and the future of our children.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to this discussion with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the gentleman who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir.
I'm glad to be here, my friend.
We've been asked to talk a bit about the Thomas Jefferson Hour. The show is described as a radio program in search of the truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. What kind of truth are you searching for, and how does Jefferson's legacy light the way?
Well, we're interested in truth with a capital T, you know, where we are as a civilization, what we value, our perplexities, the unresolved questions that date back to the colonial period and maybe beyond. There are many windows on the truth, but one of the great windows, as far as I'm concerned, is the life and achievement of Thomas Jefferson. In certain ways, Jefferson embodies the great dream and the great perplexity of the American experiment. So that's a window we can use to ask questions. If this were just about the historical personage named Thomas Jefferson, who lived between 1743 and 1826, I would have lost interest in it more than a decade ago, and I don't think our listeners would be coming back to the program week after week either. It's clearly about Jefferson, but it's in a sense more through Jefferson than it is about him, if that makes any sense.
So we hope you'll join us for the Thomas Jefferson Hour every Sunday morning at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Millions of kids across the country are starting school. Yesterday, we shared a report from Public Radio's Todd Zwillig for The Takeaway about access to early childhood education. Programs are being added, but it's spotty across America, and as more kids are attending school earlier, what they're learning and how they're learning it varies from classroom to classroom, and it often doesn't match up with the best science. That's the lesson that Suzanne Buffard learned when she began to look at pre-kindergarten programs for her own toddler. At the time, Buffard was a child development specialist at Harvard, and the experience set her on a course across the country visiting classrooms for her new book titled The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. Buffard says the importance of early childhood education is recognized now more than ever, and that right now might be our best chance to get it right.
It's the most important year for a number of reasons. For many children, this is their first experience of school. It's their first opportunity to get excited about learning and about the idea of school. And that feeling can stay with them for the rest of their education. And we're at a really interesting and important time in the history of early childhood education because we have more funding for public pre-K and other early childhood programs than ever before. But I have been worried over the last few years as I've seen programs scale up very quickly that we're not paying enough attention to how we're doing that. And that if we don't pay attention to that now at the beginning of creating our pre-K programs, we may look back regretfully in a few years, or even worse, policymakers may look back and say, we tried pre-K, it didn't work, let's move on to something else.
Because they didn't do it right in the first place. Well, I definitely want to talk about the science of what works and whether it's reaching little classrooms. But before we do that, what do we know about small children and their brains and their abilities that informs how early they should start school and what that should be like?
We've known for a long time that early childhood is a critical period for developing all kinds of skills. But over the last decade, we've developed a really large base of research that shows just how much brain development happens during early childhood. And that's because the brain makes more connections more quickly during early childhood than at any other time. And if you nurture those pathways and you foster them, the brain makes more and more connections. But the pathways that you don't use get pruned off, as neuroscientists say, in a kind of use it or lose it mentality. While we don't have a specific age that we know is important for kids to start learning in a classroom, we do want all young children to have enriching learning experiences from birth. There are a lot of ways that children can get that, whether it's at home or in an early childcare program or in a playgroup. But as children get older, to ages 3 and 4, there are some real benefits to beginning to experience a classroom environment, because it helps young children learn to be part of a class, to follow the expectations for a classroom, and interact with their peers in a way that they don't when their families are around. For example, there are some studies that suggest that children who are in kindergarten classrooms with larger percentages of classmates who went to preschool do better. It's really interesting because in that case, it's not even whether the child herself went to preschool, but whether her classmates did. It's especially true for children from low-income families and for children with low language skills when they come in.
So let's talk about best practices before we talk about anything else. What are the best programs doing that's right out of the research that they should be doing?
They engage children in learning in ways that are exciting and interesting and that are developmentally appropriate. They do things like introduce children to the world around them, to how things work. They ask them questions about, what are you thinking? Why did you design the block ramp that way? And what happened when you experimented with cars to see how fast they would go? They really get children thinking. And one of the ways they do that is to set up activities that are hands-on and that are fun and that to children are play, but they have a learning goal in mind.
So those are some of the best practices in programs around the country. What about the worst?
One of the things that concerns me the most are classrooms that are really focused on drilling basic skills. And in my reporting, I saw that these kinds of programs are more common in neighborhoods that tend to serve low-income children. The reason for that, the justification given is often that children from less resourced families tend to start school behind. So when I visited classrooms that have what is sometimes called a skill and drill approach, they did a lot of lecturing at children, a lot of flashcards, a lot of chanting songs, very little of the hands-on exploratory play that I described before. And young children's brains are just not wired to learn that way. And I've seen myself, when I've visited these classrooms, that it often turns children off to learning. And at a very young age, they decide that school is a boring and punitive and uninteresting place to be.
So all of this is really important, Suzanne Bouffard. There's no question about it. Let's be honest. I mean, one of the facts that came out on this show yesterday is that many, many young children across the country don't have access to funded pre-K programs. So if a lot of these kids are at home, what are some of the basic things that mom and dad can do to at least get close to the experience, to replicate the kind of learning that you're saying is so important for these 3 and 4-year-olds?
The most important thing is for families to make learning a part of everyday life. That includes reading and asking questions about what you read, pointing out interesting things that you see in the world, whether you're pointing out the letter that starts your child's name when you see it on a sign outside, or whether you're counting how many stones you see on the path. Those kinds of things help children's brains develop, and they also get children in the habit of being curious and being learners. That being said, it's also important to try to expose your child to opportunities like children's museums and libraries and other kinds of public spaces. Many families don't have the resources to do those things. And that's one of the real concerns, that the families who don't have the resources to send their children to early education programs may also be lacking in the resources to do those kinds of things. Kids who are not in early education programs are home for a variety of reasons. Some families make that choice intentionally. And then there are some children who are home or with a grandparent or with a neighbor because that's really all that's available to them and possible. So across all these spaces, we need to make sure that children have opportunities to learn, whether it's in a classroom or a community center or a library or in conversation with the adult they spend time with.
Suzanne Bouffard, thank you for being here and for spending this time.
Thank you so much for covering this topic.
Suzanne Bouffard is a child development specialist, and she's author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten, and the Future of Our Children.
That was From the Takeaway with host Todd Zwillig. Coming up on Main Street, an Inside Energy Report. Chef Rosie talks about cantaloupe, and we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The record floods in the northern Red River Valley would pale in comparison to what would happen if the region received the type of rainfall soaking Texas from Hurricane Harvey. Greg Gust of the National Weather Service office in Grand Forks says the 1997 flood was fueled by 8 to 10 inches of water equivalent snowpack. He says imagine 20, 30, or even 40 inches of rain.
If you had 20 inches, and we're talking, you know, rivers pushing through twice as much water as we've ever seen, which means, you know, there's no spot in the city of Grand Forks or Fargo or any of these communities that would stay above water.
Gus says compounding the problem is that Hurricane Harvey drenched an area 300 miles wide.
Just about every county in this area, in eastern North Dakota, northwest Minnesota, has received at least one episode where they've gotten 10 inches of rain in, but one rain gauge, one reading somewhere in that county, at least once in the last century, some places twice. And now it's not just one county, but it's 20 counties. That's unbelievable.
Hurricane Harvey is expected to be the costliest natural disaster in U.S. history. With a range of conditions across the state in terms of drought severity, North Dakota farmers are also seeing a range of results when it comes to harvesting this year's wheat crop. Erica Olson is a marketing specialist with the North Dakota Wheat Commission.
We're seeing fairly good quality this year. Higher protein, of course, and that's not unexpected given the hot, dry conditions that we've seen across much of the growing region. Very little disease pressure or damage from disease. The color of the vitreous kernel content has been quite high coming in from the western areas. We have seen some samples with, you know, lower test weights, smaller kernels, again, because of some of those drought effects. But overall, the crop is looking very well.
It's bittersweet news for the farming community. Olson says while some farmers in western North Dakota cut their crops for hay due to the dry conditions, those that were able to keep their crop are seeing some of the best results in the state. And a delegation of bakers from Japan toured North Dakota this week, learning more about hard red spring wheat and this year's crop. Again, North Dakota Wheat Commission's marketing specialist Erica Olson says the team is made up of representatives from four of Japan's largest baking companies.
You know, normally we get teams that have milling representatives, procurement representatives. So these are, you know, technically the last step in the chain. They're making the products that the consumers purchase.
Olson says the visit gave the team a chance to familiarize themselves with the production system, as well as learning aspects about grain quality. She says along with meeting growers and touring the North Dakota Mill and Elevator, the group had the opportunity to meet and work with researchers at NDSU.
Well, usually on the baking side of things, the most important for bread, for example, is loaf volume. So the quality of that loaf of bread, they want a nice big loaf. And so in order to get that, they need a flour that's going to have very good baking absorption, a strong flour, a high quality flour. So those are the important things that they look at. And all of that comes back to, you know, the quality of the wheat that we grow here in the field.
With the visit to North Dakota complete, the team is off to Portland, Oregon before heading home. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hello, everyone. This is Clay Jenkinson of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, heard every Sunday at 11 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public. Thomas Jefferson was the founder of the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. In fact, he listed it as one of his three primary achievements on his tombstone. As a Jefferson scholar, I find it impossible not to discuss the recent dramatic events in Charlottesville. We've had a flood of emails about this at the Jefferson Hour, asking us to put this in some sort of historical context. I will be talking about it not as the third president, Thomas Jefferson, but as humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson this Sunday on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Please listen.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Yesterday, we had an Inside Energy story about an issue common to energy-producing states. People and oil and gas development don't always make good neighbors. This is especially true in northern Colorado, where tensions among residents, energy producers, and lawmakers are playing out in battles over drilling projects. But the uncomfortable intersection of tons of people living on top of rich fossil fuel resources is forcing communities and companies to figure it out. Inside Energy's Lee Patterson reports.
A young, up-and-coming energy company called Extraction Oil and Gas has an unusual business plan. CEO Matt Owens explains in a promotional video.
Extraction was formed with the purpose of developing resources in urban settings.
It's called urban drilling. Advances in drilling technology have allowed energy companies to access untapped reserves. Some of that happens to run underneath towns and subdivisions north of Denver, like the town of Broomfield, where Extraction is hoping to move in. Drilling 99 wells on four pads over the course of a year or so. When Broomfield resident Becky Early heard about it,
I was shocked, and I didn't think it would happen. I didn't think it would get to this point. I was shocked.
I met her at a packed rec center in Broomfield during one of the many recent public meetings about the drilling proposal. Susan Phillips Spies is a member of the town's oil and gas task force, and for her, it's personal. She says wells would go in less than 1,000 feet from her house.
Literally in my backyard, yes.
The task force has put thousands of hours into drafting new town rules, trying to get ahead of the game before drilling starts. They've gathered baseline data on air quality and analyzed regs from other municipalities. The rules include recommendations for air and water monitoring, a larger minimum distance between homes and drilling, and disclosure of all chemicals that could be brought on site.
If they understand the preeminence of health, safety, and welfare, they might have an easier time getting what they want.
So what is Extraction doing about health, safety, and welfare? I went up to the 53rd floor of Denver's tallest skyscraper to find out.
Things like electric rigs, which we introduced to this basin, the sound walls that you see that
Brian Kane, Extraction's director of public affairs, ticks through some of the company's plans for Broomfield, removing dozens of old oil and gas wells, reducing truck traffic by using pipelines, and they'll use new, quieter fracking equipment developed by Liberty Oilfield Services, shown off here in a video. Extraction's senior project manager, Chandler Newhall, describes what we're seeing.
If you go watch the video, they walk up to it, they open up one of the walls, and then you can hear some of the sounds start to come out of the equipment, and then they close the door on that piece of equipment. And then, you know, the sound's dampened by doing that.
In addition to this new technology, Extraction says it will spend millions on landscaping so that all this infrastructure looks a little bit less like infrastructure. Now, all of this high and low tech stuff doesn't come free. In recent financial documents, Extraction warned that costs could go up thanks to all of these urban operations. That, coupled with the need to negotiate with the task force, begs the question, why even bother with Broomfield? Spokesman Brian Kane again.
We don't really get to choose where the natural resources are. Everything, you know, north of Denver is effectively a part of the Denver-Julesburg Basin.
A basin with tons of fossil fuel production and tons of people. Here's Matt Lepore, Colorado's top oil and gas regulator.
I think the circumstance in Colorado is pretty much unprecedented anywhere in the country. Colorado is easily one of the fastest growing states in the nation, so do the math.
So the state has been forced to deal with certain impacts of drilling early on, sometimes before other states, passing regulations related to issues like methane emissions and groundwater testing. But for many communities, it's not enough. Susan Phillips Spies of the Oil and Gas Task Force says Broomfield is taking the lead right now.
We're being watched by the state as a whole. We're being watched actually nationally. And if we can set the bar of how it can be done properly, I think we've done a good job.
But the job is far from done. Earlier this month, Extraction weighed in on Broomfield's draft rules with some complaints. In written comments, they said that a handful of the recommendations on health and safety are either in conflict with state law or would make drilling totally uneconomical. The city council plans to make a decision on the draft next month. For Inside Energy, I'm Lee Patterson.
For more information on this story and other energy news, visit InsideEnergy.org. Coming up, Chef Rosie talks about a late summer garden treat.
Support for Bright Public is provided by FM Rotary Foundation's 5th Annual Rotary Ride, September 9th at Lindenwood Park, Fargo. Proceeds go to Gigi's Playhouse and Charism. Registration information is available at fmrotaryride.com. And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. Chef Rosie talks about food every week on our show.
And one thing about this time of year, we get a lot of great food straight out of the garden, like cantaloupe. And sometimes you go to the grocery store and you get cantaloupe and it just tastes like a weird, hard, non-tasty thing.
You know, I hate to open the program with stirring the pot.
But, you know, in some places I read about cantaloupe and it was a fruit, and there was other places they called it a vegetable, and I go, oh, no, we're going to come into this again. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's just leave it as a fruit because that's what we all know it as and that's what we eat it as. And there are so many different varieties and it has so many different flavors that it's a fruit that we've become very comfortable with because it ships very well. They pick it hard as a rock. Okay, that's good and it's bad because it's always in the grocery store because it ships so well. But how often do you get it very ripe? And because they can mold very easily, they dip them in some kind of a solution. So it's getting harder and harder to find the one in the grocery store by smell that's ripe or by weight that it's ripe. Or in the case of the fruit we're talking about today, a cantaloupe, it used to be if it had any green tinges in the netting on the outside, and I call that netting, that's what we see in North American cantaloupe, that you don't see that netting in the European cantaloupe. Really, ours is a musk melon, not a cantaloupe. The real cantaloupe is what they have in Europe, and it has a smooth skin very similar to a honeydew. But because so many times we find it in the grocery store and we go home excited to eat it, and it may be bright orange or whatever, light orange, but then you eat it and it's no flavor at all because it was picked so unripe. Similar to tomatoes, you know, it can be, you can gas ripen it, but it's just never the same as if it got ripened on the vine.
It sounds like you're suggesting we shouldn't get it in the grocery store.
Well, I didn't. Don't go that far. If you happen to live in a part of the country or a part of the world that they grow it, of course, we always say, if you're lucky enough to go out in the field and get it, oh, when it's 90 degrees out and you get to harvest a cantaloupe that's ripe and the juice inside is 80 degrees, oh, you'll just, when it, we've all had peaches or cantaloupe when you bite into it and it just drips down your chin and maybe onto your shirt and you go, that's the best peach I've ever had. And it is peach season, by the way, so I just went through this a couple of days ago. Yeah.
Is it good for us?
You know, it's very high in vitamin A and vitamin C, and it's high in fiber, and it's only 60 calories per cup. But back to the same thing as watermelon, it is over 90% water. So it's more hydration than anything. I wouldn't look for it to be your source of total vitamin A and C. But it also is loaded with carotene. And carotene is what we get mostly out of carrots. We're lucky enough that one tells us. And some places you read that it's similar in the amount of carotene of carrots, but then another place said it's not even a third of the amount of carotene. So I'm sure it varies by the variety. But, you know, it's always the things we add to it. It's when we put a scoop of Häagen-Dazs vanilla ice cream on it. That's when we've added the calories and the fun stuff. And I think Häagen-Dazs will fix anything.
Well, if you get a flavorless one, though, from the grocery store, it makes sense to put a whole bunch of ice cream on it or something. Are there some other suggestions you have for us?
You know, I think my favorite is always what the South Americans, Mexican Latinos do, and that is to cut it into chunks or wedges or crescents, and then you can either freeze it or put it in ice water, but then put a popsicle stick in it and then either sprinkle it with cinnamon and sugar and eat it as a sweet cantaloupe popsicle if it's frozen. Or better yet, just what I really love is to take any of your favorite melons and put it on a popsicle stick and dip it in either lemon juice, lime juice, orange juice, your call, and then sprinkle it with cayenne.
Ooh.
So now we're getting a little bit of this, the bite of sweet from the cantaloupe, and then just that, you know, you can decide how much cayenne, or maybe use chipotle, or maybe whatever your favorite hot seasoning is. It could be hot sauce, it could be cayenne sprinkled on. But either way, I love that yin and yang of the sweet and hot is probably my favorite. But I do remember as a kid many times, and I saw in the old classic hotels like the Waldorf and the Drake and those classic hotels where you would cottage cheese with melon. That was one of the appetizers on the menu in classic hotels, and you got it often in big catering functions in those hotels, a little what we call monkey dish filled with melon with a scoop of cottage cheese on top of it. And, of course, the obligatory paprika sprinkled on top of the cottage cheese. We all know that never added any flavor, but it looked kind of nice. But yogurt, your favorite yogurt with cantaloupe is wonderful. Custards are wonderful. But let's not forget also that anytime we heat up a fruit, whether you're lucky enough to pick an orange in Florida and eat it hot off the tree, and you've never experienced an orange until you've had it picked hot off a tree. Well, the same thing, you can take cantaloupe and put it on the grill. You have your cooking walleye this summer and cut cantaloupe wedges and brush it with black pepper and oil and put it on a super hot grill and mark it and then eat it as a hot. It accentuates the flavor in a big way. So now we're trying to, we're heating it up to bring out the flavor, but we can, at that time when it comes off the grill, sprinkle it with maple syrup or cane sugar or whatever other fruits to eat with it. But we're back to that. We're trying to fix something that wasn't very good to start with.
And just to clarify here, you're not cooking the cantaloupe. You're heating it up, giving it some grill marks. And
all
stuff.
We're doing is giving it, whether you give it a little smoke or a little bit of grill marks, a little bit of char. But char adds a really nice, caramelizes the natural sugar in the fruit. Smoke, I'm just thinking about smoking cantaloupe right now, and I'm, you know, I've never done it, but it's going through my mind of, you know, you always think, no, you can't do that. Come on, you can't do a smoked cantaloupe. But you know what? I'll probably fire up the Traeger tonight if I can find a decent cantaloupe and throw one in there and give it a shot.
Well, because, you report back to us next week.
You know, everybody wraps cantaloupe with prosciutto or whatever your favorite imported ham is or cured meats. Well, why not hot bacon that's been candied or caramelized in maple sugar or maple syrup and wrap that around. So we have the hot caramelized crispy bacon wrapped around an ice cold piece of cantaloupe.
You don't have to make that a question.
Yeah, right, right. Everybody's had, you know, but we get so stuck on things, the prosciutto and melon. I mean, that's just become, that's what we know. Well, if we don't have prosciutto, I guess we can't do it. Well, of course, we could use any of hundreds of thousands of different cured meats would be just fine.
Well, bon appetit, cantaloupe. If you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
What's happening is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week, we try to answer the question, what is food writing? David Leet, creator of the blog Leet's Culinaria, says that food writing isn't just about cooking and eating. It's an entry point into deeper themes about the human condition. Also on this week's show, we make rye chocolate chip cookies, and Dr. Aaron Carroll argues for the program Meals on Wheels. Coming up this week on Mill Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, when the question is asked that way, you've got to work on an answer. And Ashley Thornburg and I are looking at what's happening over the Labor Day weekend.
And you get a chance to see history come alive this weekend in Medora at the Chateau de Moore's historic site as you hear from the Marquise de Moore. And you might be intrigued to know that Medora is actually named after this woman, and she is going to be appearing, if you will, portrayed by Karen Nelson, and she will be speaking as Madame de Moore's and talking about her life, her return to Medora after spending summers there from 1883 to 1886, and we learn about her life in western North Dakota and how that compared to her life in France. 10:30, 1:30, and 3:30 Mountain Time are these speeches, and they are all free.
Well, Seth Habhegger, this one is for you. Happy Bay Day. It's a Beyoncé dance party. It's Sunday. It's in Fargo at the Aquarium right downtown. It's celebrating the Queen's birthday, the Bay Day, in the best way possible. All Beyoncé all night long. You can get that freakum dress ready and get in formation. Doors open at 9. The show's at 10 o'clock. It's 21-plus age group, so and no cover. So come dance and enjoy yourself to honor Beyoncé.
You're going to go to that, right?
Oh, you bet. I'll be in formation.
Are you going to be in costume?
I don't think so.
Oh, I think you better. Labor Day sing-along Monday, September 4th in Bismarck at the former Governor's Mansion State Historic Site. You can learn about the history of Labor Day folk songs at 1 o'clock. Again, this is at the former Governor's Mansion Historic Site. There's also going to be an acoustic instrument sing-along with Chris Kitko. She is a very talented singer-songwriter from the Bismarck area. specifically gets going at 1 o'clock this event, but the mansion itself will be open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Labor Day. The event is free and open to all ages. There will also be ice cream and lemonade.
Well, it's that time of year. College football is getting underway, and Potato Bowl USA, the world's largest French fry feed and fireworks, is just a week from today in Grand Forks at University Park. The world's largest French fry feed and fun for all. We'll have games, inflatables, and UND athlete meet and greets. It begins at 4 o'clock on Thursday, again, September 7th in University Park. Following the feed, there'll be a fireworks display at dusk in Memorial Stadium. It starts at 4. That's the French fry feed, and the fireworks start at 9. It doesn't cost anything.
This weekend in Minot at the Public Library, Saturday the 2nd, there's going to be the History of Video Games. You might know that it is National Video Game Day coming up later in September, but you can celebrate that early at the Minot Public Library with some speakers talking about the history of video games, and you can see just how far we have come since trying to play... What's that really early one? Pong?
Oh,
yeah.
Since trying to
play some of those. 1 o'clock Saturday, the 2nd in Minot at the Public Library. It's free and there will be pizza.
Well, Bonnie Raitt is going to be around this area a couple of times. Bonnie Raitt with the Indigo Girls and Annie Humphrey are Friday at the Blue Stem Amphitheater in South Moorhead, and Tuesday, September 5th with Anders Osborne at the Bismarck Event Center. Now, the Moorhead Show, which is Friday night, is a benefit concert for Honor the Earth in support of environmental issues in Native American communities. The music for the Moorhead Show starts at 7 Friday, and the cost for that benefit, $36.50 to $86.50.
You can take a tour on Saturday the 2nd. They're calling this Last Bell Tour, and it is at the Fort Union Trading Post historic site, which is a little bit north of Sydney, Montana, and a little bit west of Williston, North Dakota. You can get a tour from a costumed tour guide as you navigate through historical scenes in a candle-illuminated Fort Union Trading Post, and you get to go back to the summer of 1860. And learn about gold discoveries and how they changed the fate of the Upper Missouri and Fort Union forever. This is outdoors. Weather can change a lot in this area, so dress appropriately. Tours begin every 15 minutes, starting at 8 p.m., and they go until 9:15, and they are all free.
The World in Fargo-Moorhead Photo Exhibit is next Tuesday in Fargo at the Main Library downtown. The World in Fargo-Moorhead is a community project designed to raise awareness about the diversity of people living in the FM community. The project consists of photographs and quotes from people who are foreign-born but now live among us. They may be immigrants, refugees, international students, or workers on temporary visas, and they may have lived here 50 years or just one day. It runs from 9 in the morning until 6. Again, that's Tuesday, September 5th at the Downtown Library in Fargo, and it's free.
Fargo Fashion Week at the Avalon Events Center, September 5th through the 8th. Most of the events get going at 6 p.m. and last until roughly 9 or 10 p.m. Tickets anywhere from $10 to $100, depending on which events you are going to take in. There's going to be a large runway show, free appetizers, live performances, of course, free stuff. Everybody loves a good swag bag. Again, September 5th through the 8th in Fargo at the Avalon Event Center, 6 to 9 p.m. on those dates.
Our friend Wes Anderson in Valley City always reminds us that the Whoever Can Come Band will be hosting a free and open to all jam session at the Barnes County Museum from 1 to 4 on Saturday, September 2nd. Bring an instrument and play along.
All right, I'm going for my pick of the week because this is a big one, Labor Day weekend, and that is a big Steam Threshers reunion that takes place every year in Rolog. This is throughout the weekend, lots of different machines kind of like walking through these time periods, and you can see the advances that have come in these big pieces of equipment that got going in 1940 as just a you know, kind of one of those, hey, wouldn't this be cool? And then has grown into a bigger and better event every year in Rolog, September 1st through the 4th.
And it's literally heavy metal. And here's a really big one. It's the Minnesota State Fair. It's the Great Minnesota Get-Together. It runs through Labor Day at the State Fairgrounds in Falcon Heights. It's one of the bigger fairs, and it's famous for food on a stick, political schmoozing, music, blue ribbon displays, art, and barns filled with animals. Gates open at 6 every day and through the fair. Adults, they define as 13 to 64, cost $14 to get in. Seniors, 65 plus, $9. Kids, 5 to 12, $12. And children under 5 are free. And that is what's happening.
So, did we go too fast? Or do you just want to find out more about the events you just heard? Well, you can. Just go to prairiepublic.org and click on the Events tab, and there, too, you can submit your own events. And who knows, maybe it'll be featured on a future What's Happening here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 31st. The stretch of U.S. Highway 2 in North Dakota has a string of towns with English names. York, Norwich, Surrey, and Leeds. Leeds dates back to 1886. The Great Northern Railroad founded the town at the site of a community previously known as Barker. It's about 30 miles northwest of Devil's Lake. On this date in 1887, the post office at Leeds was established, still in the days of Dakota Territory. Leeds took its name from the town in Yorkshire, England. Other Upper Dakota towns took English names to please English stockholders of the railroad, like Norwich, which is 15 miles east of Minot. Leeds became a village in 1899 and incorporated as a city in 1903. Its first mayor was Elisha Bartlett Page. He was a farmer who settled in Benson County in the spring of 1890 at the age of 24. Over 17 years, he acquired 600 acres of land near the town. Leeds' population nearly doubled under his and other mayors' terms, jumping to over 600 residents from 1900 to 1910. Over 720 people called Leeds home by 1930. Today, there are about 450 residents. Leeds is located near sites of interest like Rugby, which claims the geographical center of North America, and Devil's Lake, North Dakota's largest natural lake. To the northwest is the Turtle Mountains, and in every direction, farmland. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
And the next thing I remember is standing in the room next to a man holding a rifle. I didn't know what time it was. I think it was dark outside, I guess, the early hours of the morning. In the dark, I could see another armed person guarding my bedroom door.
Join us for stories of living under the gun. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, women make up the majority of the world's poor. A new book, co-edited by Concordia College theology professor Hilda Koester, explores how Christian doctrine could address the suffering. We'll also have Tom Eason with a Plainsfolk essay titled Anthem of the Plains. News director Dave Thompson always joins us on Friday to discuss the week's big stories, and Madeline will have another review. This week it's Wind River. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.